he has not given his own consent. There must be no taxation without representation, a phrase that had been used in Ireland for more than a generation. And in rejecting the rule of the juryless Admiralty Court in enforcing this law, the instructions declared that there must be a trial by jury and an independent judiciary. In amazingly little time, the document was adopted by 40 towns, something that had never happened before. Now fully joined in Boston's political ferment, Adams was meeting with Gridley, James Otis, Samuel Adams, and others. Observing them closely, he concluded that it was his older second cousin, Samuel Adams, who had the most thorough understanding of liberty. Samuel Adams was zealous and keen in the cause of steadfast integrity, a universal good character. The esteemed Otis, however, had begun to act strangely. He was liable to great inequities of temper, sometimes in despondency, sometimes in rage, Adams recorded in dismay. Otis, a protege of Gridley, had been for Adams the shining example of the lawyer-scholar, learned yet powerful in argument. Now he became Adams's political hero, just as Thomas Hutchinson became Adams's chief villain. A lifetime later, Adams would vividly describe Otis as he had been in his surpassing moment in the winter of 1761, in argument against writs of assistance, search warrants that permitted customs officers to enter and search any premises whenever they wished. Before the bench in the second-floor council chamber of the Province House in Boston, Otis had declared such writs, which were perfectly valid in English law and commonly issued in England, null and void because they violated the natural rights of Englishmen. Adams, who had been present as an observer only, would remember it as one of the inspiring moments of his life, a turning point for him as for history. The five judges, with Hutchinson at their head as Chief Justice, sat in comfort near blazing fireplaces, Adams recalled, all in their new fresh robes of scarlet English cloth, in their broad hats and immense judicial wigs. But Otis, in opposition, was a flame unto himself. With the promptitude of classical illusions, a depth of research, and a torrent of impetuous eloquence, he hurried away all before him. By Adams's account, every one of the immense crowded audience went away as he did, ready to take up arms against writs of assistance. Then and there was the first scene of the first act of opposition to the arbitrary claims of Great Britain, Adams would claim. Then and there the child independence was born. But by 1765, it was the tragic decline of James Otis that gripped Adams. At meetings now, Otis talked on endlessly and to no point. No one could get a word in. Otis is in confusion yet, Adams noted a year or so later. He rambles and wanders like a ship without a helm. Adams began to doubt Otis's sanity, and as time passed, it became clear that Otis, his hero, was indeed going mad. A dreadful spectacle. The year 1765 has been the most remarkable year of my life, Adams wrote in his diary that December. The enormous engine fabricated by the British Parliament for battering down all the rights and liberties of America, I mean the Stamp Act, has raised and spread through the whole continent a spirit that will be recorded to our honor with all future generations. At home, with my family, thinking, reads the entry of a few nights later. At home, thinking, he wrote Christmas Day. With the repeal of the Stamp Act by Parliament in the spring of 1766, and the easing of tensions that followed in the next 2 years until the arrival of British troops at Boston. Adams put politics aside to concentrate on earning a living. He was thinking of politics, not at all, he insisted. He was back on the road, riding the circuit, the reach of his travels extending more than 200 miles, from the island of Martha's Vineyard off Cape Cod, north to Maine, which was then part of the Massachusetts Bay Province, to as far west as Worcester. As recalled in the family years later, he was endowed for the profession of law with the natural gifts of a clear and sonorous voice, a ready elocution, stubbornness, but with the countercheck of self-control, and a strong moral sense. He handled every kind of case. Land transfers, trespass, admiralty, marine insurance, murder, adultery, rape, bastardy, buggery, assault and battery, tarring and feathering. He defended, not always successfully, poor debtors, horse thieves, and smugglers. He saw every side of life, learned to see things as they were, and was considered, as Jonathan Sewell would write, as honest a lawyer as ever broke bread. In 1766, like his father before him, Adams was elected selectman in Braintree. But so active had his Boston practice become by 1768 that he moved the family to a rented house in the city, a decision he did not like, fearing the effect on their health. He established a Boston office and presently admitted two young men, Jonathan Austin and William Tudor, to read law with him, in return for fees of £10 sterling. "What shall I do with two clerks at a time?" Adams speculated in his diary, adding that he would do all he could for their education and advancement in the world, a pledge he was to keep faithfully. When Billy Tudor was admitted to the bar 3 years later, Adams took time to write to Tudor's wealthy father to praise the young man for his clear head and honest heart, but also to prod the father into giving his son some help getting started in his practice. Adams had seen too often the ill effect of fathers who ignored their sons when a little help could have made all the difference. With the death of Jeremiah Gridley the year before and the mental collapse of James Otis, John Adams, still in his 30s, had become Boston's busiest attorney. He was under full sail, prospering at last, and in the Adams tradition he began buying more land, seldom more than 5 or 10 acres of salt marsh or woodland at a time, but steadily, year after year. Among his father's memorable observations was that he never knew a piece of land to run away or break. Eventually, after his brother Peter married and moved to his wife's house, John would purchase all of the old homestead, with its barn and 53 acres, which included Fresh Brook, to Adams a prime asset. In one pasture, he reckoned, there were 1,000 red cedars, which in 20 years, if properly pruned, might be worth a shilling each. And with an appreciative Yankee eye, he noted, a quantity of good stone in it, too. He was becoming more substantial in other ways. "My good man is so very fat that I am lean as a rail," Abigail bemoaned to her sister Mary. He acquired more and more books, books being an acknowledged extravagance he could seldom curb. With one London bookseller, he had placed a standing order for every book and pamphlet of reputation upon the subjects of law and government as soon as it comes out. "I want to see my wife and children every day," he would write while away on the court circuit. "I want to see my grass and blossoms and corn. But, above all, except the wife and children, I want to see my books." In the privacy of his journal, he could also admit now, if obliquely, to seeing himself as a figure of some larger importance. After noting in one entry that his horse had overfed on grass and water, Adams speculated wryly, "My biographer will scarcely introduce my little mare and her adventures." He could still search his soul over which path to follow. "To what object are my views directed?" he asked. "Am I grasping at money or scheming for power?" Yes, he was amassing a library, but to what purpose? Fame, fortune, power, say some, are the ends intended by a library. The service of God, country, clients, fellow men, say others. Which of these lie nearest my heart? What plan of reading or reflection or business can be pursued by a man who is now at Pownalboro, Maine, then at Martha's Vineyard, next at Boston, then at Taunton, presently at Barnstable, then at Concord, now at Salem, then at Cambridge, and afterward Worcester, now at Sessions, then at Pleas, now in Admiralty, now in Superior Court, then in the Gallery of the House. Here and there and everywhere, a rambling, roving, vagrant, vagabond life. Yet, when Jonathan Sewell, who had become Attorney General of the province, called on Adams at the request of Governor Francis Bernard to offer him the office of Advocate General in the Court of Admiralty, a plum for an ambitious lawyer, Adams had no difficulty saying no. Politically, he and Sewell were on opposing sides, Sewell having become an avowed Tory. Yet they tried to remain friends. "He always called me John, and I him Jonathan," remembered Adams, "and I often said to him, 'I wish my name were David.'" Both understood that the office, lucrative in itself, was, in Adams's words, a sure introduction to the most profitable business in the province. Sewell, with his large Brattle Street house in Cambridge, was himself an example of how high one could rise. Yet so open a door to prosperity, not to say the gratification to one's vanity, that a royal appointment might offer, tempted Adams not at all. With Boston full of red-coated British troops, sent in 1768 to keep order as another round of taxes was imposed by Parliament, this time on paper, tea, paint, and glass, the atmosphere in the city turned incendiary. Incidents of violence broke out between townsmen and soldiers, the hated Lobsterbacks. The crisis came in March of 1770, a year already shadowed for John and Abigail by the loss of a child. A baby girl, Susanna, born since the move to Boston and named for John's mother, had died in February at a little more than a year old. Adams was so upset by the loss that he could not speak of it for years. On the cold, moonlit evening of March 5th, 1770, the streets of Boston were covered by nearly a foot of snow. On the icy, cobbled square where the Province House stood, a lone British sentry posted in front of the nearby Custom House was being taunted by a small band of men and boys. The time was shortly after 9. Somewhere a church bell began to toll, the alarm for fire, and almost at once crowds came pouring into the streets, many men up from the waterfront brandishing sticks and clubs. As a throng of several hundred converged at the Custom House, the lone guard was reinforced by 8 British soldiers with loaded muskets and fixed bayonets, their captain with drawn sword. Shouting, cursing, the crowd pelted the despised redcoats with snowballs, chunks of ice, oyster shells, and stones. In the melee, the soldiers suddenly opened fire, killing 5 men. Samuel Adams was quick to call the killings a bloody butchery, and to distribute a print published by Paul Revere, vividly portraying the scene as a slaughter of the innocent, an image of British tyranny, the Boston Massacre, that would become fixed in the public mind. The following day, 34-year-old John Adams was asked to defend the soldiers and their captain when they came to trial. No one else would take the case, he was informed. Hesitating no more than he had over Jonathan Sewell's offer of royal appointment, Adams accepted, firm in the belief, as he said, that no man in a free country should be denied the right to counsel and a fair trial, and convinced on principle that the case was of utmost importance. As a lawyer, his duty was clear. That he would be hazarding his hard-earned reputation, and in his words, incurring a clamor and popular suspicions and prejudices against him, was obvious. And if some of what he later said on the subject would sound a little self-righteous, he was also being entirely honest. Only the year before, in 1769, Adams had defended four American sailors charged with killing a British naval officer who had boarded their ship with a press gang to grab them for the British Navy. The sailors were acquitted on grounds of acting in self-defense, but public opinion had been vehement against the heinous practice of impressment. Adams had been in step with the popular outrage, exactly as he was out of step now. He worried for Abigail, who was pregnant again, and feared he was risking his family's safety as well as his own. Such was the state of emotions in Boston. It was rumored he had been bribed to take the case. In reality, a retainer of 18 guineas was the only payment he would receive. Criticism of almost any kind was nearly always painful for Adams, but public scorn was painful in the extreme. "The only way to compose myself and collect my thoughts," he wrote in his diary, "is to sit down at my table, place my diary before me, and take my pen into my hand. This apparatus takes off my attention from other objects. Pen, ink, and paper, and a sitting posture are great helps to attention and thinking." From a treatise by the eminent Italian penologist and opponent of capital punishment, Cesare Marchese di Beccaria, he carefully copied the following. "If, by supporting the rights of mankind and of invincible truth, I shall contribute to save from the agonies of death one unfortunate victim of tyranny or of ignorance equally fatal, his blessings and years of transport will be sufficient consolation to me for the contempt of all mankind." There were to be two conspicuously fair trials held in the new courthouse on Queen Street. The first was of the British captain, Thomas Preston, the opening of the trial being delayed until October when passions had cooled. The second was of the soldiers. In the first trial, Adams was assisted by young Josiah Quincy, Jr., while the court-appointed lawyer trying the case was Josiah's brother, Samuel, assisted by Robert Treat Payne. Whether Captain Preston had given an order to fire, as was charged, could never be proven. Adams' argument for the defense, though unrecorded, was considered a virtuoso performance. Captain Preston was found not guilty. Adams' closing for the second and longer trial, which was recorded, did not come until December 3rd, and lasted 2 days. The effect on the crowded courtroom was described as electrical. "I am for the prisoners at bar," he began, then invoked the line from the Marchese di Beccaria. Close study of the facts had convinced Adams of the innocence of the soldiers. The tragedy was not brought on by the soldiers, but by the mob, and the mob, it must be understood, was the inevitable result of the flawed policy of quartering troops in a city on the pretext of keeping the peace. We have entertained a great variety of phrases to avoid calling this sort of people a mob. Some call them shavers. Some call them geniuses. The plain English is, gentlemen, It was most probably a motley rabble of saucy boys. Negroes and mulattoes, Irish teagues and outlandish jacktars. And why should we scruple to call such a people a mob, I can't conceive, unless the name is too respectable for them. The sun is not about to stand still or go out, nor the rivers to dry up because there was a mob in Boston on the 5th of March that attacked a party of soldiers. Soldiers quartered in a populous town will always occasion two mobs where they prevent one. They are wretched conservators of the peace. He described how the shrieking rabble pelted the soldiers with snowballs, oyster shells, sticks, every species of rubbish, as a cry went up to, "Kill them! Kill them!" One soldier had been knocked down with a club, then hit again as soon as he could rise. "Do you expect he should behave like a stoic philosopher lost in apathy?" Adams asked. Self-defense was the primary canon of the law of nature. Better that many guilty persons escape unpunished than one innocent person should be punished. The reason is because it's of more importance to community that innocence should be protected than it is that guilt should be punished. "Facts are stubborn things," he told the jury, "and whatever may be our wishes, our inclinations, or the dictums of our passions, they cannot alter the state of facts and evidence." The jury remained out 2.5 hours. Of the 8 soldiers, 6 were acquitted and 2 found guilty of manslaughter, for which they were branded on their thumbs. There were angry reactions to the decision. Adams was taken to task in the Gazette and claimed later to have suffered the loss of more than half his practice. But there were no riots, and Samuel Adams appears never to have objected to the part he played. Possibly Samuel Adams had privately approved, even encouraged it behind the scenes, out of respect for John's fierce integrity, and on the theory that so staunch a show of fairness would be good politics. As time would show, John Adams's part in the drama did increase his public standing, making him in the long run more respected than ever. Years later, reflecting from the perspective of old age, he himself would call it the most exhausting case he ever undertook, but conclude with pardonable pride that his part in the defense was one of the most gallant, generous, manly, and disinterested actions of my whole life, and one of the best pieces of service I ever rendered my country. A second son, Charles, was born that summer of 1770, and for all the criticism to which he was being subjected, Adams was elected by the Boston town meeting as a representative to the Massachusetts legislature. It was his first real commitment to politics. Inevitably, it would mean more time away from his practice and still further reduction in income. When, the night of the meeting, he told Abigail of his apprehensions, she burst into tears. But then, as Adams would relate, said, "She thought I had done as I ought. She was very willing to share in all that was to come." But the complications and demands of both the law and politics became too much, and Adams suffered what appears to have been a physical breakdown. Especially the constant obligation to speak in public almost every day for many hours had exhausted my health, brought on pain in my breast and complaint in my lungs, which seriously threatened my life, he would later write. In the spring of 1771, he and the family moved back to Braintree, to the air of my native spot, and the fine breezes from the sea, which, together with daily rides on horseback, gradually restored him. Another child, Thomas Boylston, was born in September of 1772. And again, Adams was off on the vagabond life of the circuit. carrying a copy of Don Quixote in his saddlebag, and writing Abigail sometimes as many as 3 letters a day. Business was good in Massachusetts in the calm of 1772, and Adams prospered once again. He appeared in more than 200 Superior Court cases. Among his clients were many of the richest men in the colony, including John Hancock. At the conclusion of one morning in court, Adams was told people were calling him the finest speaker they had ever heard, the equal to the greatest orator that ever spoke in Greece or Rome. He could speak extemporaneously, and if need be, almost without limit. Once, to give a client time to retrieve a necessary record, Adams spoke for 5 hours, through which the court and jury sat with perfect patience. At the end he was roundly applauded, because, as he related the story, he had spoken in favor of justice. At home, he filled pages of his journal with observations on government and freedom, notes for an oration at Braintree, as he labeled them, though the oration appears never to have been delivered. Government is nothing more than the combined force of society, or the united power of the multitude for the peace, order, safety, good, and happiness of the people. There is no king or queen bee distinguished from all others by size or figure or beauty and variety of colors in the human hive. No man has yet produced any revelation from heaven in his favor, any divine communication to govern his fellow men. Nature throws us all into the world equal and alike. The preservation of liberty depends upon the intellectual and moral character of the people. As long as knowledge and virtue are diffused generally among the body of a nation, it is impossible they should be enslaved. Ambition is one of the more ungovernable passions of the human heart. The love of power is insatiable and uncontrollable. There is danger from all men. The only maxim of a free government ought to be to trust no man living with power to endanger the public liberty. At the same time, he was vowing, at least in the privacy of his diary, to devote himself wholly to his private business and providing for his family. Above all things, I must avoid politics. But as tensions in the colony mounted, so did his pent-up rage and longing for action. On an evening with the Cranches, when a visiting Englishman began extolling the English sense of justice, Adams exploded, taking everyone by surprise, and Adams as much as any. I cannot but reflect upon myself with the severity of these rash, inexperienced, boyish, raw, and awkward expressions, he wrote afterward. A man who has not better government of his tongue, no more command of his temper, is unfit for everything but children's play and the company of boys. There was no more justice in Britain than in hell, he had told the Englishman. By the time of the destruction of the tea, what was later to become known as the Boston Tea Party in December 1773, he had again moved the family to Boston. His hatred of mob action notwithstanding, Adams was exuberant over the event. In less than 6 months, in May 1774, in reprisal, the British closed the port of Boston, the worst blow to the city in its history. "We live, my dear soul, in an age of trial," he told Abigail. Shut off from the sea, Boston was doomed. It must suffer martyrdom and expire in a noble cause. For himself, he saw no prospect of any business in my way this whole summer. I don't receive a shilling a week. Yet she must not assume he was in the dumps. Quite the contrary. He felt better than he had in years. In 1774, Adams was chosen by the legislature as one of five delegates to the First Continental Congress at Philadelphia. And with all Massachusetts on the verge of rebellion, he removed Abigail and the children again to Braintree, where they would remain. In July, he traveled to Maine, for what was to be his last turn on the circuit before leaving for Philadelphia. During a break from the court at Falmouth, later Portland, he and Jonathan Sewell, who was still Attorney General, climbed a hill overlooking the blue sweep of Casco Bay where they could talk privately. Their friendship had cooled in recent years, as had been inevitable under the circumstances. In his diary, Adams had grieved that his best friend in the world had become his implacable enemy. "God forgive him for the part he has acted," Adams had written, adding, "It is not impossible that he may make the same prayer for me." Now, Sewall pleaded with Adams not to attend the Congress. The power of Great Britain was irresistible, and would destroy all who stood in the way, Sewall warned. As long as they lived, neither man would forget the moment. Adams told Sewall he knew Great Britain was determined on her system, but that very determination determined me on mine. The die was cast, Adams said. Swim or sink, live or die, survive or perish, I am with my country. You may depend upon it. Less than a year later, after the Battle of Bunker Hill, Sewall would choose to quit America. With his wife and family, he sailed for London, never to return. "It is not despair which drives me away," he wrote before departure. "I have faith that rebellion will shrink back to its native hell, and that Great Britain will rise superior to all the gasconade of the little wicked American politicians." Not long afterward, in a series of letters to the Boston Gazette that he signed Novangelus, the New Englander, Adams argued that Americans had every right to determine their own destiny, and charged the foreign ministry in London with corruption and venal intent. America, Adams warned, could face subjugation of the kind inflicted on Ireland. Unless America took action, and at once, Adams wrote, they faced the prospect of living like the Irish on potatoes and water. Section 3. With Joseph Bass at his side, Adams crossed Long Bridge over the frozen Charles River and rode into Cambridge in the early afternoon of January 24, 1776, in time to dine with General Washington at the temporary quarters of Colonel Thomas Mifflin near Harvard Yard. Mifflin, a wealthy young Philadelphia merchant who served with Adams in the Continental Congress, had been one of the first to welcome Adams on his arrival in Philadelphia. As a fighting Quaker, he had since become Washington's aide-de-camp. Martha Washington was present with her husband, as were General Horatio Gates and his lady. When Martha Washington and Elizabeth Gates arrived in Cambridge by coach in December, it was remarked that they would surely be a welcome addition, in country where firewood was scarce. Gates, a former British officer, was an affable, plain-faced man who, like Washington, had served during the French and Indian War on the disastrous Braddock expedition. As adjutant general, he was Washington's right hand at Cambridge. Washington and Adams were nearly the same age, Washington at 43 being just 3 years older. Powerfully built, he stood nearly a head taller than Adams, 6'4" in his boots, taller than almost anyone of the day, and loomed over his short, plump wife. The three officers, in their beautiful buff and blue uniforms, were all that Adams might imagine when picturing himself as a soldier. Yet even they were upstaged by the main attractions of the gathering. A dozen or more sachems and warriors of the Ganawaga Indians in full regalia who had been invited to dine together with their wives and children. Adams had been fascinated by Indians since boyhood. when the aged leaders of the Punkapog and the Ponset tribes had called on his father. But he shared with Washington and Gates a dread fear of the British unleashing Indian war parties on the frontiers, as had the French 20 years before. Recalling what he had read and heard, Adams had earlier written to a friend, "The Indians are known to conduct their wars so entirely without faith in humanity that it would bring eternal infamy on the ministry throughout all Europe if they should excite those savages to war. To let loose these bloodhounds to scalp men and to butcher women and children is horrid." Yet, finding himself now unexpectedly in the actual presence of Indians was another matter, and he had a very different reaction. The dinner, starting at 2 o'clock, was a diplomatic occasion. The Caughnawagas had come to offer their services to the Americans, and gathered all about him, they presented a spectacle that Adams, to his surprise, hugely enjoyed. "It was a savage feast, carnivorous animals devouring their prey," he wrote in his diary. "Yet they were wondrous polite. The general introduced me to them as one of the Grand Council fire at Philadelphia, upon which they made me many bows and cordial reception." To Abigail, he reported himself decidedly pleased by the whole occasion. What he could not risk telling her by letter was that the command at Cambridge had received the most heartening news, indeed the only good news of the long, grim winter. An expedition led by young Henry Knox, a former Boston bookseller and colonel in Washington's army, had been sent to Lake Champlain to retrieve the artillery captured by Ethan Allen at Fort Ticonderoga, and haul the great guns back over the snow-covered Berkshire Mountains all the way to Boston, a task many had thought impossible. Now the noble train was at Framingham, 20 miles to the west. It was a feat of almost unimaginable daring and difficulty, and, ironically, only made possible by the severity of the winter, as the guns had been dragged over the snow on sleds. Mounted, and on their way again the next morning, with the temperatures still in the 20s, Adams and Bass were joined by a newly elected Massachusetts delegate to Congress, young Elbridge Gerry. They rode out past the pickets and campfires of Cambridge, and at Framingham stopped to see for themselves the guns from Ticonderoga, Adams making careful note of the inventory. 58 cannon, ranging in size from 3 and 4 pounders to one giant 24-pounder that weighed more than 2 tons. Clearly, with such artillery, Washington could change the whole picture at Boston. The three riders pressed on through the gray and white landscape, making 20 to 25 miles a day. "A cold journey," Adams wrote. The weather was persistently wretched. There was more snow, wind, and freezing rain. With dusk coming on by 4 in the afternoon, and the bitter cold turning colder still, the glow and warmth of familiar wayside taverns was more welcome than ever. Under normal circumstances, Adams nearly always enjoyed such stops. He loved the food, wild goose on a spit, punch, wine, bread and cheese, apples, and a leisurely pipe afterward, while toasting himself by the fire. He picked up news, delighted in scenes and characters, as he said, enough for the amusement of Swift or even Shakespeare. It was in such places that he had first sensed the rising tide of revolution. A year before the first meeting of Congress in 1774, riding the court circuit, he had stopped one winter night at a tavern in Shrewsbury, about 40 miles from Boston, and as he would recall for Benjamin Rush years afterward, the scene left a vivid impression. "As I was cold and wet, I sat down at a good fire in the bar room to dry my greatcoat and saddlebags till a fire could be made in my chamber. There presently came in, one after another, half a dozen or half a score substantial yeomen of the neighborhood, who, sitting down to the fire after lighting their pipes, began a lively conversation upon politics. As I believed I was unknown to all of them, I sat in total silence to hear them. One said, "The people of Boston are distracted." Another answered, "No wonder the people of Boston are distracted. Oppression will make wise men mad." A third said, "What would you say if a fellow should come to your house and tell you he was come to take a list of your cattle that Parliament might tax you for them at so much a head? And how should you feel if he should go out and break open your barn to take down your oxen, cows, horses, and sheep?" "What would I say?" replied the first. "I would knock him in the head." "Well," said a fourth, "if Parliament can take away Mr. Hancock's wharf and Mr. Rowe's wharf, they can take away your barn and my house." After much more reasoning in this style, a fifth, who had as yet been silent, broke out, "Well, it is high time for us to rebel. We must rebel some time or other, and we had better rebel now than at any time to come. If we put it off for 10 or 20 years and let them go on as they have begun, they will get a strong party among us and plague us a great deal more than they can now. As yet, they have but a small party on their side." But now, at town after town, the atmosphere was edged with melancholy. The talk was of defeat at Quebec and the dire situation at Boston. Snow lay deep most of the way, with drifts banked against buildings and stone walls, trees bare against the sky, the wind seldom still. No part of the journey was easy or uplifting to the spirits. Instead of welcoming committees and church bells, there was only the frozen road ahead. The one bright note was young Jerry, who belonged to the so-called codfish aristocracy of Marblehead, his father having made a fortune shipping dried cod to Spain and the West Indies. Like Adams, indeed, like every member of the Massachusetts delegation, Jerry was a Harvard graduate, a slight, bird-like man, age 31, who spoke with a stammer and had an odd way of contorting his face, squinting and enlarging his eyes. But he was good company. Because of the family business, he had traveled extensively and was an ardent patriot. He and Adams talked all the way, making the journey, as Adams related to Abigail, considerably less tedious than it might have been. Their days together on the wintry road marked the start of what was to be a long, eventful friendship. Like Adams, Jerry viewed mankind as capable of both great good and great evil. Importantly now, they were also of the same heart concerning what had to be done at Philadelphia. Abigail had already said what John knew needed saying when, in November, a petition was circulated at home calling for reconciliation with Britain. "I could not join today in the petitions, for a reconciliation between our no longer parent state by a tyrant state and these colonies," she wrote. Then, making a slight but definite dash mark with her pen before continuing, as if to signify her own break from the past, she said, "Let us separate. They are unworthy to be our brethren." Passing through New York, Adams bought two copies of a small anonymous pamphlet, newly published under the title Common Sense. Keeping one, he sent the other on to her. Adams and his two companions arrived at Philadelphia on Thursday, February 8, 1776, 15 days after leaving Braintree. His first letters from Abigail did not reach him until more than a month later, and were filled with accounts of thrilling events. The American bombardment of Boston had begun March 2nd and 3rd. "No sleep for me tonight," she wrote as the house trembled about her. On March 5th, she described a more thunderous barrage. "The rattling of the windows, the jar of the house, and the continuous roar of the 24-pounders." The night before, working at great speed, Washington's men had moved the guns from Ticonderoga to commanding positions on the high ground of the Dorchester Peninsula, south of Boston, looking over Boston Harbor and the British fleet. With hundreds of ox teams and more than 1,000 American troops at work, breastworks had been set up and cannon hauled into place, all in a night and to the complete surprise of the British. Abigail was told that the British commander, on seeing what they had accomplished, remarked, "My God, these fellows have done more work in one night than I could make my army do in 3 months." Days of fearful tension followed, until Sunday, March 17th, St. Patrick's Day, when she went again to the top of Penn's Hill to see a spectacle such as no one could ever have imagined. The British were abandoning Boston. General William Howe had struck an agreement with Washington. If allowed to depart in peace, the army would not leave Boston in flames. The entire fleet, the largest fleet ever seen in America, was lifting canvas in a fair breeze and turning to the open sea. "You may count upwards of 170 sail," she wrote. "They look like a forest." The British had been outwitted, humiliated. The greatest military power on earth had been forced to retreat by an army of amateurs. It was a heady realization. As would be said by the Duke of Manchester before the House of Lords, "The fact remains that the army which was sent to reduce the province of Massachusetts Bay has been driven from the capital, and the standard of the provincial army now waves in triumph over the walls of Boston." With the departing fleet sailed 1,000 loyalists, many well known to John and Abigail Adams, including John's first mentor in the law, James Putnam of Worcester, and Samuel Quincy, brother of Hannah and Josiah, and Adams's opposing counsel in the Boston Massacre trials. "That such had come to pass," wrote Abigail, "was surely the work of the Lord, and marvelous in our eyes." Chapter 2. True Blue. We were about one-third Tories and one-third timid, and one-third true blue. John Adams. Section 1. Philadelphia, the provincial capital of Pennsylvania on the western bank of the Delaware River, was a true 18th-century metropolis, the largest, wealthiest city in British America, and the most beautiful. Visitors wrote in praise of its very exactly straight streets, its many fair houses and public edifices, and of the broad, tidal Delaware, alive in every season but winter with a continuous traffic of ships, great and small. Though more than 100 miles from the open sea, it was America's busiest port, with wharves stretching nearly 2 miles along the river. The topgallants of huge merchantmen loomed over busy Water Street and Front Street. Cutters, shad boats, and two-masted shallops tied up moved in and out in company with the great flat-bottomed Durham boats built to carry pig iron from the Durham works upstream. Shipbuilding was a thriving industry, seagoing trade the city's lifeblood. Ships outbound carried lumber and wheat, Pennsylvania's chief exports. Inbound ships brought European trade goods and, from the West Indies, sugar, molasses, spices, and increasingly now, European armaments and supplies for war. With no means for producing arms or gunpowder, the colonies were dependent on clandestine shipments from Europe by way of the Caribbean, and particularly the tiny Dutch island of St. Eustatius. One vessel reportedly docked at Philadelphia with 49,000 pounds of gunpowder. Because of Pennsylvania's reputation for religious tolerance and an abundance of good land available to the West, Philadelphia was the principal port of entry to America. The incoming tide of English, Welsh, Scotch-Irish, and Palatine Germans had been growing steadily. In numbers, if not in influence, Presbyterians and Baptists had long since surpassed the Quakers of the Quaker City. 50 years earlier, when young Benjamin Franklin arrived from Boston with a single Dutch-German dollar in his pocket, Philadelphia had been a town of 10,000 people. By 1776, its population was approaching 30,000. Larger than New York, nearly twice the size of Boston, it was growing faster than either. As conceived by its English Quaker founder, William Penn, in 1682, the plan of Philadelphia was a spacious grid, which, to a man like John Adams, accustomed to the tangle of Boston's narrow streets, seemed a sensible arrangement. "I like it," Adams had declared in his journal at the time of the first Congress, when, newly arrived and filled with curiosity, he set off with his walking stick, resolved to learn his way about. "Front Street is near the river, then Second Street, Third, Fourth, Fifth, Sixth, Seventh, Eighth, Ninth," he recorded. "The cross streets which intersect these are all equally wide, straight, and parallel to each other, and are named for forest and fruit trees, Pear Street, Apple Street, Walnut Street, Chestnut Street, etc." The main thoroughfare was High Street, commonly called Market Street, as it was the location of the immense public market. Most streets near the waterfront had brick footwalks and gutters, and were lit at night by whale oil lamps, except when the moon was full. Many of the principal streets were lined with trees. "This is the most regular, neat, and convenient city I ever was in, and has made the most rapid progress to its present greatness," declared an English visitor. But it was the public buildings and churches that made the greatest impression. The State House, where Congress met, and nearby Carpenter's Hall, which had been the setting for the first Congress, Noble Christ Church, as Adams called it, with its magnificent Palladian window and landmark spire, the new hospital, the new poorhouse, the new Walnut Street prison, were all unusually handsome and substantial. Silas Deane of Connecticut thought the poorhouse, or bettering house, equal to anything of its kind anywhere. "All this is done by private donation, and chiefly by the people called Quakers," he informed his wife. To another Connecticut delegate, Oliver Wolcott, the massive new jail more resembled a prince's palace than a house of confinement. Public-spirited Philadelphians, inspired by Benjamin Franklin, had established the first volunteer fire company in the colonies, the first medical school, and a library. Franklin himself, Philadelphia's first citizen, was the most famous American alive. Printer, publisher, philosopher, scientist, and, as inventor of the lightning rod, the man who tamed the lightning. It was Franklin also who had led the way in establishing the American Philosophical Society for the promoting of useful knowledge, with the result that Philadelphia had become the recognized center of American thought and ideas. Other eminent members of the Philosophical Society included John Bartram, who, west of town on the banks of the Schuylkill River, had created the first botanical garden in America, Dr. Benjamin Rush, an enterprising young physician and champion of humanitarian reform, and David Rittenhouse, clockmaker, optician, instrument maker, and self-taught astronomer, who, to study the transit of Venus in 1769, had erected an incongruous-looking observation platform that still stood on the grounds of the State House. Topics of consideration at the Philosophical Society, as set forth in Franklin's initial proposal, were, in the spirit of the age, all-embracing. all philosophical, scientific experiments that let light into the nature of things tend to increase the power of man over matter and multiply the conveniences or pleasures of life. All new discovered plants, herbs, trees, roots, and methods of propagating them. New methods of curing or preventing diseases. New mechanical inventions for saving labor. All new arts, trades, manufacturers, etc., that may be proposed or thought of. As it was, Philadelphia manufacturers and artisans produced more goods than in any city in America. Boots, wigs, hardware, fancy carriages, Franklin stoves, mirror glass, and no end of bricks for a city where nearly everything was built of brick. Thomas Affleck produced furniture as fine as any made in the colonies, all in the fashionable style of the English cabinet maker Chippendale. John Berendt on 3rd Street advertised what may have been the first piano made in America, a just-finished, extraordinary instrument by the name of a pianoforte, made of mahogany, being of the nature of a harpsichord. With 23 printing establishments, and by 1776 7 newspapers, more newspapers even than in London, Philadelphia was the publishing capital of the colonies. It was not only that Franklin's immensely popular Poor Richard's Almanac emanated from Philadelphia, but political pamphlets of such far-reaching influence as John Dickinson's Letters from a Pennsylvania Farmer, Thomas Jefferson's spirited Summary View of the Rights of British America, and now Common Sense, which was selling faster than anything ever published in America. Shops in nearly every street offered an array of goods and enticements such as most delegates to Congress could never find at home. Everything from French brandy and Strasbourg snuff to fancy chamber pots, artificial teeth, or ordinary pins of the kind John Adams purchased in great heaps to send home to Abigail. John Sparhawk, proprietor of the London bookstore on 2nd Street, in addition to volumes on medicine and law, sold scientific instruments, swords, spurs, and backgammon tables. There were as many as 30 bookshops and twice the number of taverns and coffee houses, with names like Blue Anchor, Bunch of Grapes, Tun Tavern, Conestoga Wagon, Rising Sun, Half Moon, and each had its own clientele. The Freemasons convened at the staid old Indian King on Market Street. The London Coffee House at the southwest corner of Front and Market, in the commercial center, was the favorite of the leading merchants and sea captains. Indeed, the place where much of the city's business was transacted. While the new, larger City Tavern on the west side of 2nd Street, between Walnut and Chestnut, had become the great gathering place for members of Congress. Adams, recording his first arrival in Philadelphia in August 1774, had written that, "Dirty, dusty, and fatigued as we were, we could not resist the importunity to go to the City Tavern," which he decided must be the most genteel place of its kind in all the colonies. It was there, at the City Tavern, a few days later, that Adams had first met George Washington. Distilleries and breweries were thriving. Adams found the local beer so much to his liking that he temporarily abandoned his usual hard cider. "I drink no cider, but feast on Philadelphia beer," he acknowledged to Abigail. To anyone unaccustomed to city life, the crowds and noise seemed overwhelming, and worst were market days, Wednesdays and Saturdays, when German-speaking country people came rolling into town in huge farm wagons loaded with produce, live chickens, pigs, and cattle. The thundering of coaches, chariots, chaises, wagons, drays, and the whole fraternity of noise almost continually assails our ears, complained a visiting physician. Delegate Stephen Hopkins from Rhode Island one day counted 70 farm wagons on Market Street. Swarms of people moved up and down the sidewalks and spilled into the streets. At no point on the American continent could so many human beings be seen in such close proximity or in such variety. Sailors, tradesmen, mechanics in long leather aprons, journeymen printers, house painters, sailmakers, indentured servants, black slave women, their heads wrapped in bright bandanas, free black stevedores and draymen, mixed together with Quaker merchants and the elegance of the city and their finery. Everyone busy about something, and everyone, it seemed to visitors, unexpectedly friendly and polite. Few delegates to Congress ever became accustomed to the bustle and noise, or to the suffocating heat of a Philadelphia summer, or to the clouds of mosquitoes and horseflies that, with the onset of summer, rose like a biblical scourge. Prices were high. Lodgings of even a modest sort were difficult to find. Conditions for the poor appeared little better than in other American cities. Misery, too, was on display. Delegates to Congress were frequently approached by beggars, and, as in every city of the time, the scars and mutilations of disease and war were not uncommon among the passing crowds. Further, Philadelphia was notorious for its deadly epidemics of smallpox. During the most recent outbreak, in 1773, more than 300 people had died. In his initial eagerness to see everything, Adams had made a tour of the new hospital. Led below ground to view the lunatics locked in their cells, he saw to his horror that one was a former client from Massachusetts, a man he had once saved from being whipped for horse stealing. Afterward, upstairs, Adams walked between long rows of beds filled with the sick and lame, a scene of human wretchedness that tore at his heart. But if bothered by pigs loose in the streets or the stench of rotting garbage and horse manure, he wrote nothing of it. Besides, like others, he found that to the west, toward the Schuylkill River, the city rapidly thinned out, beginning at about 6th Street. By 8th, beyond the hospital and the Potter's burial ground, one was in open country. To a man who thought nothing of walking 5 to 10 miles to rouse the spirits, it was a welcome prospect. There were fields with wild strawberries in summer and scattered ponds, which in winter were filled with skaters, the most accomplished of whom, doffing their hats, performed something called the Philadelphia salute, a bow, much like in a minuet. One fair afternoon, as if to clear their heads, Adams and two or three others climbed the bell tower of Christ Church, up a series of dimly lit narrow ladders, past the great bells in their yokes, to a point 100 feet above ground, where a trapdoor led to the open air of the arched lantern, above which rose the church spire. Steadying themselves on a slightly canted roof, they looked over the whole of the city, the long sweep of the river, and the farmland of New Jersey to the east. The breeze at that height was like nothing to be felt in the streets below. With the rest of the Massachusetts delegation, Adams had moved into a lodging house kept by a Mrs. Sarah Yard on the east side of 2nd Street, across from City Tavern. A tally of his expenses shows charges for room and board of 30 shillings a week in Pennsylvania currency, not including firewood and candles, which were extra. "My time is too totally filled from the moment I get out of bed until I return to it, with visits, ceremonies, company, business, newspapers, pamphlets, etc., etc., etc.," he had reported excitedly to Abigail. On Sundays, the one day of respite from Congress, he was at church most of the day, attending services twice, even three times. With numerous denominations to choose from, everything except congregational, he tried nearly all, the Anglican Christ Church, the meeting houses of the Methodists, Baptists, Presbyterians, Quakers, the German Moravians, and passed judgment on them all, both their music and the comparative quality of their preaching. The Reverend Thomas Coombe of Christ Church was sprightly and distinct. "But I am not charmed," wrote Adams. "His style was indifferent." Indifference was a quality Adams found difficult to tolerate. The Methodist preacher was another matter. "He reaches the imagination and touches the passions very well." One Sunday, led by curiosity and good company, which included George Washington, Adams crossed a Romish threshold to attend afternoon Mass at St. Mary's Catholic Church on Fifth Street, an experience so singular that he reflected on it at length both in his journal and in a letter to Abigail. Everything about the service was the antithesis of a lifetime of Sabbaths in Braintree's plain First Church, where unfettered daylight through clear window glass allowed for no dark or shadowed corners or suggestion of mystery. For the first time, Adams was confronted with so much that generations of his people had abhorred and rebelled against, and he found himself both distressed and strangely moved. The music, bells, candles, gold, and silver were so calculated to take in mankind that he wondered the Reformation had ever succeeded. He felt pity for the poor wretches fingering their beads, chanting,